Welcome to Genesis. We're glad you're here this morning. Today is actually the last in a series that we've been doing through the fall up till this point on what it looks like for us as within the context of Christianity, within the context of church, to interact with the culture around us. And we've been looking, as part of that, looking just at different people that have come from church history. We kind of did this chronologically, so we started all the way back in the 4th century with a guy named Augustine and have brought it all the way up to almost our current day with Dr. Martin Luther King, and just tried to look at people who interacted with the culture around them as followers of Jesus, and what did it look like for them to deal with the culture that was around them in a way that reflected both grace and truth. Often there are pressures and forces in the context of the culture that come against us as we're following Jesus and trying to figure out what that looks like. And when that happens, it can be difficult for us to know how to engage the culture, be a part of the culture. And as a church, we are passionate about the fact that we don't want to withdraw. Like a lot of churches, their response to the world around them is to just kind of pull into a shell, withdraw, and create a little subculture that is the Christian subculture. And we kind of have our own language, our own way of doing things, our own way of speaking. We get off freaked out when Starbucks doesn't put a snowflake on a coffee cup, right? And we create this little Christian subculture that thinks the world should be for us, and actually it's just the opposite. It should be the fact that Christ is transforming us, and then we should live in the world as agents of transformation. And I was thinking about this. This was a Back to the Future year, right? 2015, and everybody kind of, I started a couple years ago thinking, oh my gosh, that's close. I remember in 1985 imagining 2015, and it was impossible. It was about the same time that Prince came out with Partying Like It Was 1999. And that seemed just as far in the future to me, like it would never happen. Then 1999 came, and Y2K didn't happen, and I was thankful for that. But then all of a sudden we went forward, and still 2015 seemed way out there. Well, guess what? We passed it, right? And it was interesting to engage this, to look at Back to the Future movies and to think about, and they've been on like every network. Like if you haven't seen Back to the Future this year, you just haven't been trying. Because like everybody's been playing Back to the Future marathons, all this stuff. So we got Marty McFly and Doc Brown, right? And they start in 1985. Their culture is the culture of 1985. And one of the things that's interesting about the movies is the fact that it takes them to three other times. Marty goes to 1955, and then he comes back to 1985, right? And then he goes from 1985 to 2015, and we are thankful that they got at least one thing wrong in that movie. The Cubs did not win the World Series. That was a good thing, right? And then you had Marty interacting and Doc interacting with the culture of 2015, what was supposed to be our day, and we had hoverboards and flying cars. Well, that didn't come true, but there were some things that they got right in the look at 2015, but culture changed. Well, then they went from there back to 1885 as a lightning bolt struck the DeLorean that was flying. And if you haven't seen any of these, wow, you need to get out in culture more, just saying. It goes back to 1885, and then Marty goes back and meets him, and then they have to deal with the culture of 1885. One of the things that the movie did well is it helped us see what it looks like when a person of one culture now is dropped into the middle of another culture. And the way it really showed up was in the way Marty kept trying to dress. He would show up in a culture, and he would think he was dressing like the culture, and somebody would have to look at him and go, man, they're going to kill you if you keep wearing those clothes. That doesn't fit here at all. He's running around 1885 in 1955 Western gear that looked like, you know, Howdy Doody. And when he walks into the saloon, he looks like an idiot. When he goes back from 1985 to 1955, people can't make sense of what he's wearing. And his mom, who is flirting with him, I know that's weird, and once again, you got to see the movie, but keeps calling him Calvin Klein because he has on Calvin Klein underwear, which were cool in 1985, right? And you have this interplay with all these cultural issues as these two characters find themselves in four different cultures, and actually a fifth one is there is an alternative universe, 1985, that they go back to. They end up in all these cultural universes functioning as people that are from 1985. And it is the interplay of that that makes the movies really entertaining. But here's why I bring this up. We are living in a world where the culture is changing. Not necessarily in the form of flying cars and hoverboards. We are living in a world where the culture is changing at the speed of light in terms of the way here in our country, here, Western thought and specifically American culture, the way the world sees itself, the way the world sees worldview, the way the world sees religion, the way the world sees right and wrong, the way the world sees things like sexuality and sees things like values and ethics and all that sort of stuff. And the culture has shifted, and it's shifting at the speed of light. And what's going on in a very large part is that the church is still living, a lot of churches are living in 1955. Every church is contextually relative for some culture. The question we always have to ask is, which culture are we culturally relative for? And there's a lot of churches that are culturally relative for the period of the emergence of the baby boomers in the period of 1955. There's another group of churches that really, they are the 1985 church. They're culturally relative. They still speak the language and play the music of 1985, and they call themselves contemporary because they're not 1955. What's going on right now is that we as followers of Jesus are having a really hard time figuring out how we navigate the real 2015. And what has to happen is that we have to go to the gospel and to the scriptures, which are timeless, but we have to do that in living in a world that is the world of this moment, this time, today, and have to learn how to engage the struggles, answer the questions, but encounter people in this world. And it's not going to work if we are still wearing the clothes, the religious clothes of 1985. And we're having a hard time navigating this period. And so what happens is the response within the context of Christianity. And if you're not a follower of Jesus, I'm admitting some of our failures right now. The response has either to pull to ourselves and create this little subculture, this Christian subculture, this Christian bubble, and say, man, really what you need to do is you need to abandon the culture and just come live inside the bubble. Only have relationships with us. Let's be at church all the time. Let's only do this. And we have, like I said, our own lingo, our own music, our own, you know, systems of doing things. We end up with our own retail stores and our own whole, you know, economic system sometimes. But the other response that often happens is people, in an effort to engage the culture, lose the gospel. And they're living in the world, and they are really relational with the culture around them, but they have lost the only thing that they can say that will be transformative. And so what I hope this series, if you've been here the whole time, what I hope this series has done for all of us is helped us wrestle with, how do we think different? Think different than the culture, think different from the church of 1985, think different from just kind of the what has been the religious line on certain issues and certain attitudes, and really even looking at the whole worldview that our culture holds and says, how do we do this where we look like Jesus in our interaction? And what we find in the New Testament as you read the story of Jesus is that he was incredibly relational with people that nobody from the religious culture would ever engage. That's always been one of the things that has deeply resonated with me, that when I was in Christianity, I was in the church, I was in, and they had a true gospel. But most of the people that resembled the people that Jesus actually hung out with found themselves as massive outsiders. And people in our church literally told us, you don't hang out with those people, they might rub off on you. And I kept trying to figure out how Jesus is hanging out with pimps and prostitutes and people from other cultures and people that like no good, right-thinking Jew would ever hang out with, would ever be relational with. Jesus keeps spending a lot of time and going to parties and being intentionally relational with them. And that very thing became something that even in the context of my churches, we didn't know how to interact with that. And I think the fact that we get locked into a culture within Christianity, I'm talking big picture American Christianity now. I think the fact that we get locked into a culture and have responded to certain things in our culture poorly has led to the fact that the culture at large now looks at us with a lot of cynicism and says, we don't want to hear the voice of the church because we have failed on some of these things so badly. Now, on one hand, we can be full of grace, which means we're intentionally engaging people and loving them. That needs to happen. But we can't do that while abandoning truth, the clear truth of the gospel. But we also can't hold on to truth in such a way that we use it like a weapon, like a stick to beat people with, rather than looking at Jesus, who is the gospel, and letting him teach us and remind us. And so this morning, we're going to interact with the issue of race, the gospel and race. And I know for some of you in the room already, that makes you uncomfortable. It becomes something we've talked about several times, and it may seem like I'm addressing it a lot. We've had several sermons. We had somebody come a couple years ago and preach a parable for us from the city, an African-American man. He did a great job, and we've been engaged this a few times. But there's a few reasons why I think we do need to come back to this here. As we engage this. But my hope this morning is we're going to go to a story here in a few minutes. I actually want to go from the issue of race to kind of tying a bow on the whole series and say, it doesn't matter what the issue is, whether it's race or morals challenges or the way people see the world, our response needs to look a lot more like Jesus, no matter what it is. But why should we look at race and this issue? You know, we're in a community that's 93% Anglo and 75% married houses. I mean, this isn't here, but it is permeating our culture. And a church that goes silent on the issue of race will lose its ability to interact with other issues because the world's wondering what our response to these issues are. It really is. We may not like that, but it really is wondering how will specifically the white church respond. And that has been a challenge for us all through the last 200 years, to be honest with you. And so in our culture, we know we had Ferguson, but since Ferguson, there's been so much that has happened, and it just seems like this issue isn't going away. And I'm going to be honest with you, it's not only is it not going away, the issue of race is going to grow because the conversation about race is going to move very quickly from the response to African-American culture, and it's going to move very quickly to the fact that the nations are coming to us, okay? So immigration up until World War I was mostly European cultures. And before World War II, there were a few other cultures that have come. What's happened in the last, especially the last decade, is that it is the nations who are moving to our doorstep. So that here in St. Louis, we have the largest population of Bosnians anywhere outside of Bosnia. I mean, here in St. Louis, a huge population of people from the Middle East. And now there's all these questions about what it looks like to deal with immigration and what it looks like to deal with these people coming. The possibility of Syrians may be coming, they may not be coming. And there's all kinds of complex political issues. I'm not wading into that. I'm still telling you that it's complex and we need to pray for those who govern us to wrestle with this. I know that safety is an issue. And I will acknowledge from Romans chapter 13 that the government's, their mandate is the safety of its people. But there's also the issue that our hearts ought to move in the direction of Jesus when it comes to dealing with individuals. And so I'm not trying to say this is what the politics ought to look like. I'm asking the question this morning, as the gospel fills us. So if you're a follower of Jesus, as the gospel fills you, what should it do to the posture of your heart towards any person on this planet? But for us, the issue of race is everywhere. And so what I've watched, and this is the part that makes my heart just struggle and sometimes in the privacy of my own moments mourn, is that God has called me and placed me in a place that is mostly Anglo. And there tends to be a posture of our heart towards issues of race that is just ingrained in us. We don't even know it's there often. That sees ourselves as better and naturally takes a step away. Now, that may not be you, but just the language I hear often in our culture, the language I see, we're always defending certain things and the way we do life, the way we see things, that the general mindset that I gather from us here, and not just here, us, you know, kind of across the board. And I'm preaching to us. If I preach this in an African-American church, I wouldn't avoid it, but I would preach it differently, okay? But to us, there's a tendency to distance and feel an aura of superiority, and that's just not what the gospel should be producing in the people of God. And what's going on is that the culture around us knows that's true, but we don't. And therefore, when it comes to other issues that the culture raises, we have lost our voice because of our failure in this issue. You can disagree with me, but hang around with some young people. Young Christians. I'm telling you, Christians under 30 are super aware of the fact that our failures to speak prophetically into some of these issues has caused us to lose our voice in this culture. And it is, race is a gospel issue. In fact, there is a story in the New Testament we referenced a couple weeks ago where Paul has to literally address Peter, two New Testament heroes, about the fact that he had some racial issues. And Paul tells Peter that the reason he is responding the way he was responding was because he didn't believe the gospel. Something in his heart was awry because he was not applying the gospel to his own heart, the good news of Jesus. And so what I want to do this morning is I want us to wade through a really cool story and wrestle with this story as Jesus encounters somebody who is a total outsider on every level from Jesus' culture. On every level, this person Jesus is going to interact with is a total outsider. And I want us to think about this when it comes to the gospel and race. I want us to think about, how do I respond? What's the posture of my heart as I respond to Ferguson or to Chicago or to whatever the issue is? But I also wanted to think about, what is the posture of my heart when I listen to stories about Muslims in the Muslim world? What is the posture of my heart when I think about the girl who in her brokenness and as a pregnant woman is on the outside door of a pregnancy center? I want us to think about the posture of our heart when we think about the people who live in our neighborhoods and who are like just down the street, and we have no idea who they are and we don't know what their hurts and pains are. I want us to think of the posture of our heart as we address people who are living in broken neighborhoods. I had the amazing, just blessed privilege as somebody in our church stood up and said that we were made aware of a need in the city of somebody who actually goes to this school but lives in Jennings. And we were made aware of a need, and somebody in our church jumped up and said, man, we're going to take this family a Thanksgiving meal. And on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, man, it was amazing. We drove to this neighborhood. It was a poor neighborhood. It was a broken neighborhood. It was a tough neighborhood. And I called this lady, and her first words are, oh, bless you, bless you. Oh, I cannot wait. God is so good. God is so good. And we pull up to her door, and it's just this little bitty house. We walk up the steps, and she's just praying. Jesus, she wraps her arms around me and hugged both me and this other person who went in. We walk into their living room, and in a room that is the size of my kitchen, which is their living room, there were 8 children in there. Like, they were piled on top of each other just watching this little bitty tube TV. And we had the privilege of delivering them a Thanksgiving meal. They were so thankful. What is the posture of our heart when we look at these issues? How do we engage this when we look at Haiti or any other culture? I mean, whatever that is. Because I think at the core, what the gospel has to do to us is it has to change the way I see myself in this world before it can call me to something different. And so John chapter 4, crazy cool story. I love this story. If you have a Bible, find John chapter 4. We're going to look at this whole story, 30 verses long, this story of Jesus interacting with what we know as the woman at the well. And the story is going to tell us about how Jesus interacts And what I want us to see is this. First of all, I'm going to show you at the end how Jesus has to be our Savior before he can be our model. But I'm going to show us first how Jesus is our model. What can we learn from how Jesus interacts with this woman, this situation? What can we learn from this that will help us engage, I mean, anybody? Yes, the issue of race, but way beyond race, the issue of, you know, when somebody has a different view of morality, somebody has a different view of marriage, somebody has a different view of social issues, whatever it is, how should we follow the example of Christ in this? So grab your Bible, page 760 in Bibles at the end of your rows. We'd love for you to have one of those and read along with us. If you have an app, you can find that, and we're going to read John chapter 4, and I'm just going to kind of wade through the story. So I'm going to read and tell the story, and then when I get done, I'm going to come back and pull some application to say, what does this look like for us to engage this, all right? So, now when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize but only his disciples, he left Judea and departed again for Galilee, and he had to pass through Samaria. So this is what we find out. Jesus is in the region that's around Jerusalem, and they are preaching and teaching, and he's gathering disciples, and they're doing some baptizing that looked a lot like what John the Baptist was doing. And all of a sudden, the Pharisees start taking notice, and they're not real, like, they don't like the idea of two prophets gathering a crowd around Jerusalem. One's enough, and that's probably too much for their way of life. We talked a little bit about this last week. And so Jesus feels like it's time to go back to this region of Galilee, which is his home region. So he's going to go back north through the nation of Israel back to Galilee. And so everybody who lived in north in Galilee were Jews, Jewish people from Jewish culture, Jewish religion, Jewish nationality. Everybody who lived around Jerusalem were Jewish people, Jewish culture, Jewish nationality, Jewish religion, all that kind of stuff. But smack dab in the middle, right between Galilee and Jerusalem, was this area that was called Samaria. And Samaria was filled with people who Jews despised on every level. It is a racism that was entrenched deeply in the culture. It was a racism that went back 700 years. The Samaritans' heritage is that at one point in time in their past history, they were actually also Jews. But through a lot of cultural and political and nation-rising events, they had all intermarried and had given up their distinctiveness. They began to kind of blend the God of Israel with all these other religious views, and kind of they got involved with what we've talked about this here, syncretism, where they kind of took the religion of Judaism, but mixed in the gods of all the other nations and created kind of a hybrid religion that was just different. But then through their history, the Samaritans often sided with the enemies of Israel, and led to all kinds of harassment, all kinds of struggles, and all kinds of bloodshed through the years as they would support some of the nations around them against Israel as Israel did things like try to rebuild. And there over 700 years was a growing hatred. They had set up their own temple on this place called Mount Gerizim that was supposed to be a rival to the temple in Jerusalem. And Jewish people knew that this is our place to worship, this is our place to do life, this is our place to find the one true God. And the Samaritans said, nope, this is the true place. They read some of the Hebrew scriptures, but not all of them, and interpreted them completely differently. And about 150 years before this conversation, there was a group of Jewish people who were so angry and so despised the Samaritans that they went north into Israel and basically ramshacked and destroyed their temple. And so now the Samaritans have the same hatred for the Jews that Jews have for the Samaritans. And by the time we get to the New Testament, the Samaritans and Jews would have nothing to do, not even business. They would not do business. They would not talk. They would not pass each other. They would not never look each other in the eye. They despised each other. There were two routes from Jerusalem to Galilee. One route went right through Samaria. The other route went actually across the Jordan River and went north. And not all, but most Jews would take the longer route to avoid having any contact with Samaritans. But even a Jew who would walk through Samaria would do it in such a way that he kept his head down, he didn't look up, he didn't make eye contact, and he would never stop at a place where he would have to interact with a Samaritan on any level. You make it through these towns without stopping. You pack enough where you don't, like, you have your food, you have your water. We're not going to stop at any place to get a drink. We're not going to stop at an establishment and buy something to eat. We're going to keep moving. And if we do have to stop, we're going to have to go find some place that will sell us kosher Jewish food from a kosher Jewish dude, right? And this is what it says here. And I'll come back to this. It says here that Jesus had to go through Samaria. Question is why? We'll talk about that. Verse 5. So he came. So he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar near the field that Jacob had given his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there. So Jesus, wearied from his journey, was sitting beside the well, and it was about the sixth hour. The sixth hour is about noon. So about noon, Jesus takes a seat on the side of this well that was dug by one of their ancestors, Jacob, but it had become an important place and an important town for the Samaritan people. They found a lot of value and meaning from the fact that they had their water source was made for them by one of their ancestors that ties them back to the Jewish story. Verse 7, a woman from Samaria came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink," for his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. And the Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria?" Now, let me explain what's going on. She raises a really good question that doesn't make sense to her, and we'll see in a minute it doesn't make sense to his disciples. Jesus engages this woman in a conversation. Let me tell you what the barriers are in this culture to this conversation. There is a deep-seated racial barrier. Nobody crosses those lines. And both groups saw themselves as superior than the other group, but nobody's crossing those lines. There is a gender barrier. The fact that she is a woman in this culture at this time, men do not speak in public with any woman, actually, and for many of them, even their wives. And so there is a gender barrier. There is a moral barrier. We're going to find out that this woman actually has been married multiple times. She is now living with a guy who is not her husband. And in these relationships, she is that woman. One of the interesting things I'm going to tell you right now is that as you look at the story, it's noon at the well. Listen, if you're living in an ancient culture that's a desert culture, water is vital. You have to get water every day. But you don't go in the middle of the day because it's hot. You go in the morning right after sunrise, in the evening right before the sun sets to get your daily water. You go to the well at that time. This woman's coming to the well at noon because she is probably an outcast, and it's the easiest way to avoid the stares, the looks, the interaction with people in her own culture who would look at her and go, "Yeah, that's that woman." And the guys would be gawking at her, and the women would be talking about her. So the easiest way to avoid that is just to go in the middle of the day. She shows up at noon. Nobody else is there, but Jesus is there. And she has this moral problem, this moral barrier. There's a religious barrier. The barrier between her way of seeing the world religiously and the Jews' way, which Jesus comes from. And there is a theological barrier in that she has a belief system that comes from her religion that actually is different from what Jesus is preaching and where Jesus is coming from. And all these barriers, every one of these barriers would have been enough for the average person to just go, "Nope, keeping you at an arm's length." But Jesus goes to her and he has a conversation with her, and she says, why are you talking to me? I don't get this. Why are you having a conversation with me?" Verse 10, Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would never ask him, and he would have given you living water." And the woman said, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that water? Are you greater than our father Jacob?" So here's what happens. He turns the request for her to serve him into a gospel conversation. He is now going to address the emptiness in her heart. He's going to say to her, "Listen, there is a thirst that is greater than your thirst for water. And there is a solution that is greater than this well. That while we may be thirsty, there is something deep in the core of our being that is thirsty for something greater." And Jesus says, "Listen, if you knew the gift of God and the one who was right in front of you, you would understand that I offer you a living water. You'll never be thirsty again." Now think about this. The whole image here. You have to come every day to the well and drop a bucket way down in a hole to access water and just enough to carry back to your house for the day. And Jesus says, there is an offer of water. There is an offer of water where you'll never have to come to the well again because it will become inside you, a river springing up in your heart that will fill your life with eternal life. It's a beautiful picture here of what the gospel does for the people of God. When we find Christ, when we see the gift of God and the one who is standing right in front of us. And then what happens is that water so fills us that it overflows. And it overflows to all kinds of people. It will change the way we see the world because we understand what's been done for us. And so he says, if you saw the gift of God, if you saw what was going on, you would understand. And the woman said, verse 12, are you greater than our father Jacob? Which the answer to that question is ultimately yes. He gave us the well and drank from it himself and did his son, as did his sons and livestock. Jesus said to her, everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. The woman said to him, sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water. Oh, how beautiful this is. She is now recognizing her thirst. But Jesus doesn't just go, all right, it's yours. He does interact with some things. Look at what he says, verse 16. Jesus said to her, go call your husband and come here. The woman answered him, I have no husband. And Jesus said to her, you're right in saying I have no husband, for you have had five husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true. Now, this is where, like, if you're the woman, you're like, all right, this is eerie, okay? Because he's like, hey, go find your husband. She's like, I don't have a husband. And so this guy that she's never met, who's never been in her town, goes, what you're saying is true. You don't have a husband. You've had five, and the guy you're living with now, he's not really your husband. And all of a sudden what he's done is he's lovingly, in the context of relationship, exposed the need of her heart and shown her her own sinfulness. I love the response. Verse 19, the woman said to him, sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Like, that's like the most obvious statement in the verse. Oh man, you must be a prophet. Do you think? And so he says, verse 20, she says, our fathers worshiped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship. Diversion. This is what we like, right? If we're confronted with our own need, our own sinfulness, our own need for the gospel, our first response is diversion. Let's come. Listen, I don't want you to deal with the dark recesses of my heart. I don't want anybody really exposing in me things that are sinful in me. So I'm going to come up with a way to divert rather than look at myself and be honest about me. But this is why I need the gospel. I need the gospel to confront my attitudes, my values, my lifestyle, the way I see the world, and to transform me. And so Jesus does interact with truth and say, listen, the way you're living is not the way God designed you. And she says, you worship, Jesus responds, or verse 21, Jesus said to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here where true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. And the woman said to him, I know that the Messiah is coming. He who's called the Christ, when he comes, he will tell us all things. And Jesus said to her, I who speak to you am he. Now, I don't have time this morning to wade through all the implications of what Jesus explains to her about worship in the gospel. But here's basically, on a basic level, what goes on. Jesus comes to her. She encounters him. They begin a conversation that he initiates. He allows her to serve him. It turns into a gospel conversation. And that gospel conversation ends up addressing the struggle of her life and her sinfulness, but it also addresses the religious question and the theological question as she says, You think we ought to worship there. I think we ought to worship here. Who's right? And Jesus' answer is to say, listen, the location of your worship is not as important as the one you worship and your heart in the worship. We worship in spirit and truth. You could say we worship in grace and truth. That would fit here, okay? The idea that it's this internal thing. The place is not as important as your heart that's being transformed, because you are in awe in the one you are in the presence with. And it comes when that well, that spring, that river is welling up inside you where you can't do anything but worship. And he says, this is what the gospel will do to you. It will change the way you see God, the way you see yourself, and your response to God in worship. That's what will happen when we truly meet Christ. And so her response is, we keep hearing that a prophet, the Messiah, is going to come. And our English text misses the beauty of the language here. Because what it says in your English text is this. Jesus says, I who speak to you am he. That's a bad translation, but in English there's no other way to put it. What he literally says is this. The one who is in your presence is I am. Now listen, this is what's happening. Jesus doesn't just say there's some guy showing up. He's saying, listen, there's a gift in front of you and you don't know what it is. And that gift is rich and deep, and it will well up in you, producing eternal life. And you'll never need a drink again. And she goes in all kinds of directions, but he addresses her life issue. He addresses her religion issue, and he does it with the truth of the gospel. He doesn't go, well, you know, you worship your way, we worship our way. What he says is, it's not so important how you worship or where you worship, but who you worship. And she says, we're looking for Messiah. And Jesus uses language here that identifies with the story in the Old Testament where he says, "This, I am in your presence, I am a man, but I am also the God of the universe." I am is the language of the Old Testament story, how the Hebrew people interacted with God himself. And he says, the one who is with you is I am. Now, what she does is she leaves the story and goes back to the town. She's like, man, this is a crazy conversation. She goes back and she starts interacting with everybody in her town and says, hey, here's the deal. I met a guy, and everybody's like, here we go again. And she's like, no, this guy's different. I think he's the one we're waiting for. Let me explain where this story goes. The story goes like this. She goes back, and the whole town comes out, and Jesus now has a gospel conversation with a whole city. And the end of the story at the end of John chapter 4 looks like this. This whole town of Sychar comes to hear him, and at the end of the story, they say, we now believe in you, but we don't just believe in you because of what the woman testified. We believe in you because we have heard with our own ears and seen with our own eyes, and we know that you are the one from God. It's a beautiful story of evangelism as Jesus reaches out, but I want you to see just a few things that teach us and that should push us to say, man, Jesus looks really different than most of us ever will, and we have to look at his example. So let me just hit these real quick. How is Jesus going to teach us? Let me show you how Jesus engages with the people of a different culture, a different value, different race. How does Jesus engage these people? And first of all, he engages with gospel intentionality. Gospel intentionality. In other words, what Jesus does is he goes and he engages these people on purpose. When everybody else is moving away, when everybody else distances themselves, when everybody else hears the stories and sets up barriers, Jesus has to go. And the language here is not just like he had to go, like I got to get from here to there, so I have to go this way. The point is that Jesus, knowing the will of God in his life, intentionally went to someplace that nobody else would go. Intentionally engage with the woman nobody else would engage with. No Jew, even if they take the road, is stopping and sitting on the side of a well near a Samaritan village. You're just not doing that. But Jesus intentionally goes, intentionally puts himself in a position where he's intentionally going to encounter a woman and have a conversation with somebody that, I'm telling you, nobody else would. And I just, like, the posture of our heart when we encounter people who are different from us, whether it's religiously different, culturally different, I mean, they believe in a different set of morals, the posture of our heart tends to be to take a step back. But if we're going to engage this culture, we have got to figure out how we are people moving forward intentionally. So let me just put it in the language of Ferguson. When Ferguson blows up, the tendency I have is to pull back to my own and start only listening to voices that are around me instead of finding ways to intentionally move towards the language of people who are different and listen. And just be careful that I don't only gather people that are just like me. If we're going to look like Jesus, it means that we are going to intentionally engage people that are different from us. We're going to know them. We're not going to wait for them to come to us, but we're going to find ways. Now, nobody in here can do that with everybody. But if we're truly followers of Jesus, that ought to be happening somewhere for you. And the posture of our heart needs to change so that no matter what the issue is, our hearts are pulled towards people who are different, especially when they're hurting. Listen, I am decidedly pro-life. Not ashamed of it. But my heart aches for people who've been through the horror of abortion too. And if we can't feel both of those things at the same time, we're missing the point. If all we're doing is holding up signs screaming at people who have complex lives, then there's something wrong with the way we're engaging the world, because there's issues, but there's always people in the context of those issues, right? I mean, we can name all the issues, and we know how that we can say, here's how the truth of the gospel addresses the issue, but every issue that we address is, there's millions of people and lots of people right around us who are part of that issue, and their lives are messy and complicated and broken and hurting, and they don't have, like, they're in a desert with no water spiritually. And if all we know how to do is address the issue without loving the people and going towards people, we don't get Jesus. Right? And so there's intentionality. There's also in this story, Jesus gives us a picture of what gospel relationship looks like. He does get to presenting the gospel, but he earns the right to do that by being relational with this woman in such a way that he is gracious with her. He interacts with her. He talks to her. You know, in our culture, he's at Starbucks having a cup of coffee. He's going towards, like, he's intentionally moved this direction. Now he's engaging in relationship with somebody who doesn't see the world the same way that he does. And the third thing I'll show you here is that there's deep gospel humility in Jesus. All right, so here's the deal. If there is any person on the planet who can function in this story from a place of superiority, who is it? Jesus. Like, that's it, right? All the rest of us are broken, flawed sinners that if we were put in a different life situation, our lives would look different. Jesus is the sinless Son of God. He is in this situation. And for most part, one of the challenges we have that when we go serve and we try to impact different cultures, it is hard for us to do that without a feeling of superiority. Without like, here, I'm here to serve you. Therefore, I just kind of feel like I'm better and God loves me because I'm doing this great thing for these horrible, broken people, right? It's a danger when we go to Haiti. Like, all of a sudden, we're there and it feels like, you know, these people, look at all the problems. And I discovered something, okay? I went to Haiti and hung out just about 3 weeks ago. I was in Haiti. I was at a church 3 weeks ago tonight. That was up in the mountains in Haiti, and I got to listen to them worship and celebrate Jesus. I had a few minutes to talk to them, and this is what I said to them. I said, first of all, they just got done singing about going to heaven. And I mean, the whole church erupted. It's loud. It's amazing. And so I asked them if it was okay if a few Blancs joined them in heaven. That's white people. That's us, okay? There's not like racial tension in Haiti. Everybody's Haitian, which means everybody's Black, right? But there are all kinds of other challenges. But what I found out that I asked them if it was okay if some of us joined them in heaven, and I asked them when they got there if they would mind teaching us how to sing. Because y'all, Black culture, it doesn't matter if it's African American or Haitian, they know how to worship, they know how to sing. And I just said, we need to like go through a class with y'all when we get there. Will you just lead us through a class and teach us how to sing? But this is one of the things that I found in Haiti. Haitians have found all kinds of systems and structures to, are you ready? Look down on us. They have all the reasons why we're the messed up people of the world and we're the problem. And they take a position, like, it is just the posture of the human heart and sin to look at me and mine and say, we're better. And Jesus sits down, and the first thing he does is he looks at this woman, adulterer, Samaritan, and he looks at her and goes, I have this deep need I can't satisfy myself. Will you help me? He puts him in a place where he is under this woman for a moment. It is a deep act of humility. I mean, does Jesus really need to ask this woman for a drink of water? He spoke and a water came to be. But in humility, he puts himself where he is allowing this woman to serve him. And that's what leads to the gospel conversation. That is what leads to the gospel conversation. And that's what we need to look like. It leads to the beauty of this gospel story, this gospel hope that he gives her. And so here's what happens in the story, and just kind of the final challenge for us here. As we wade through this, whether it's with racial issues, immigration issues, or the people who live across the street from us here at the holidays, what does it look like for the posture of our heart to be transformed by the gospel? Here's what happens. In this story, I'll let you read this for yourself. Just you drop your eyes at verses 27 to 30. The disciples return, and they look at Jesus, and it says wonder. It's actually disdain. The religious crowd that is hanging out with Jesus looks at Jesus and goes, what the heck's wrong with him? Why is he talking to this woman? And I read that and I realize that more often than not, I in this story am them. But then I read the story farther and I realize that really I'm the Samaritan woman. Which means before I can look to Jesus as my model, I have to find him as my living water that will spring up inside me, that will fill me with something that looks different from the way the world sees culture and challenges, and even sometimes those of us in the church see it. I'll begin to look more like Jesus in my relationships and in my intentionality and in the way I interact with questions. I won't be quick to choose sides, but I will listen. I will hurt when people hurt. I will rejoice when people rejoice. And I will move towards the brokenness in the world rather than building walls around us so that we could just look alike, sound alike, and be comfortable. That's what the gospel does. It's what the gospel does. These 12 who look in disdain will be the ones who will take the gospel to the nations. And a couple of them, about a year later, will come back to Samaria and lay hands on some people in this community, and the Holy Spirit will fall on them, and they will believe the gospel and come to deep faith in Jesus in Samaria. I don't know if it was these people or somewhere else in Samaria, but it's what happens. These same people who are looking on Jesus with disdain encounter the resurrection, drink deeply from Jesus, and they go to Samaria. That's what it does for us. And it needs to shape us. So, just kind of in closing, I want to hand you something. I have Carla's going to help us out and help us hand this out. I think she found some people. I want to give you a piece from a guy named Benjamin Watson. He's an NFL football player who's African-American. And he was on the football field when the Ferguson verdict was read. He's a follower of Jesus who is an African-American. And he wrote out some of his thoughts. And I don't know, you may or may not have seen this, but it kind of went, like, became this huge thing right after the Ferguson verdict. I just want to give you a copy of this, throw it in your Bible, but I want to read it to you as the band comes up on stage for us. There is also, and I've got this, it'll be on the Genesis blog this afternoon. There is an amazing conversation that happened last week or so, when the one-year anniversary of the verdict happening here and all the blow-up here in St. Louis. There is an amazing video with Darren Patrick and Benjamin Watson just having a cross-the-table dialogue about the challenges and issues here. And so often I hear, man, you give us all these ideas, but tell us something to do. So here's the one thing I'm going to challenge everybody in here to do. Just go watch the interview. Just sit down as the third person in the room and listen to a conversation. Okay? Do that. But this is what he says, Benjamin Watson. At some point while I was playing or preparing to play Monday Night Football, the news broke about the Ferguson decision. After trying to figure out how I felt, I decided to write it down. Here are my thoughts. I'm angry because the stories of injustice that have been passed down for generations seem to be continuing before our very eyes. I'm frustrated because pop culture, music, and movies glorify these types of police-citizen altercations and promote an invincible attitude that continues to get young men killed in real life away from safety movie sets and music studios. I'm fearful because in the back of my mind, I know that although I'm a law-abiding citizen, I could still be looked upon as a threat to those who don't know me. So I will continue to have to go the extra mile to earn the benefit of the doubt. I'm embarrassed because of the looting, violent protests, and law-breaking only confirm in the minds of many, validate the stereotypes, and thus the inferior treatment. I'm sad because another young life was lost from his family. The racial divide has widened. A community is in shambles. Accusations, insensitivity, hurt, and hatred are boiling over, and we may never know the truth about what happened that day. I'm sympathetic because I wasn't there, so I don't know exactly what happened. Maybe Darren Wilson acted within his rights and duty as an officer of the law and killed Michael Brown in self-defense like any of us would in that circumstances. Now he has to fear the backlash against himself and the loved ones that he had only doing his job. What a horrible thing to endure. Or maybe he provoked Michael and ignited the series of events that led to him eventually murdering the young man to prove a point. I'm offended because of the insulting comments I've seen that are not only insensitive but dismissive to the painful experiences of others. I'm confused because I don't know why it's so hard to obey a policeman. You will not win. And I don't know why some policemen abuse their power. Power is a responsibility, not a weapon to brandish and to lord over the populace. I'm introspective because sometimes I want to take our side without looking at the facts in the situations like these. Sometimes I feel it is us against them. Sometimes I'm just as prejudiced as people I point fingers at. And that's not right. How can I look at white skin and make assumptions but not want assumptions made about me? That's just not right. I'm hopeless because I've lived long enough to expect things like this to continue to happen. I'm not surprised at some point my little children are going to inherit the weight of being a minority and all that it entails. I'm hopeful because I know that while we still have race issues in America, we enjoy a much different normal than those of our parents and grandparents. I see it in my personal relationships with teammates, friends, and mentors, and it's a beautiful thing. I'm encouraged because ultimately the problem is not a skin problem, it is a sin problem. Sin is the reason we rebel against authority. Sin is the reason we abuse authority. Sin is the reason we are racist, prejudiced, and lie to cover for our own sin. Sin is the reason we riot and loot and burn. But I'm encouraged because God has provided a solution for the sin through His Son Jesus and with it. A transformed heart and mind, one that's capable of looking past the outward and seeing what's truly important in every human being. The cure for the Michael Brown, Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, and Eric Garner tragedies is not education or exposure, it's the gospel. So finally, I'm encouraged because the gospel gives mankind hope. Jesus, we thank you that you are better. Teach us, Lord, with the issue of race, but also with our neighbor across the street, to be filled with the gospel so that it overflows in our lives, it spills out to the world around us. And Lord, if we're here this morning and we don't know you, help us this morning. Lord, I just pray for anybody who has never experienced the beauty of the living water of Jesus, to see the gift that is before them, to feel the beauty of the Savior that is here, and embrace you as their Lord. For that we praise you. In your name I pray. Amen.